The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Thursdays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here, just back from London across the big pond. Getting back in time for our radio program this morning. My co-host, Sherry Welsh, are you there?
Yes, good morning, Danny.
Okay, thank you. So Sherry's with us, and we're going to have some fabulous guests in a few minutes. Michael Hudson is going to be joining us, as will Joshua Holland, who's a writer with Alternet. And Michael is an author, blogger, analyst, and one of the people who was early on challenging predatory lending. So we'll hear from them in a minute. You know, the big headline for people interested in these issues today is the appointment of Elizabeth Warren as an assistant to President Obama, supposedly with the mission of creating and getting the new Consumer Protection Bureau up and running in the Federal Reserve Bank. Now, I'm not really so clear about this because, although it sounds great, on the other hand, here we have a situation where her original proposal was for an independent agency. Okay? That was not enacted. Instead, she got a bureau, which was put in the Federal Reserve Bank, really put there by Chris Dodd, a senator now departing from Connecticut, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, who basically said, you know, Elizabeth Warren can't get confirmed. He was hostile to her from the beginning, favoring the financial services industry, as he has tended to do as chairman of the House Finance Committee. You'll remember he was given a very cushy mortgage by Countrywide some years back, and has been involved in other questionable practices. At any rate, Senator Dodd is on the way out, but basically tried to push Elizabeth Warren out last week at his press conference. President Obama was asked about Warren. He said, well, he hadn't really made up his mind yet. Then we had these setbacks for the Democrats in these elections, or at least the emergence of the Tea Party. And suddenly Elizabeth Warren was appointed, but not to the job which many people were hoping she would be appointed to, but to the White House. And this has led to some speculation, really inspired by the famous saying in The Godfather. It's unto this famous saying, which is, you know, keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer. So by putting her in the White House, they could be sidelining her. Or at least that's what NakedCapitalism.com, the blog, says today. Very interesting analysis of how, in a sense, Obama is doing something that, you know, many in his liberal base will applaud, you know, finally recognizing this brilliant woman and rewarding her in some way for her, you know, really battle to get this agency up and running. On the other hand, putting her in an environment where he really is in control of her, as are Tim Geithner and Rahm Emanuel and the whole White House, you know, Obamaocracy there. So what will happen with this bureau remains to be seen, but I'll be raising that with my guests this morning here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.com. The number to call if you want to join us, 888-874-4888. It's a free call, of course. This program will be available as a podcast later in the day, and I'll be posting it on my blog on mediachannel.org tomorrow. The URL I'll be posting, and actually the show that you'll be able to hear it and tell friends about it if you want to share the information that you hear here today. So welcome to News Dissector Radio one more week.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo Sally May, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also
that's the theme song from my 2006 movie, In Debt We Trust, which warned of the credit crunch and helped expose the predatory lending, something that our first guest this morning was deeply involved in, Michael Hudson, former staff writer with the Wall Street Journal. He covers business and finance for the Center for Public Integrity, a great nonprofit journalism site based in Washington, D.C., an organization. His reporting on abuses in the mortgage market has been honored with many different awards, and he's the author of a new book, The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. That's a long title. Times Books put it out. I'm sure it's an excellent book. And Michael, welcome. Do you like my theme song?
I do, Danny.
Great. I had hoped to have Michael in Debt We Trust, but another Michael Hudson sort of beat him to it. I guess he wasn't available, but I'm happy to have you on the program anyway to talk about things. Let's start with Elizabeth Warren. What's your take on this development, this announcement yesterday of her appointment as a special assistant to President Obama?
Right. It's a little unclear what it means yet. I mean, the one thing that I will say about Elizabeth Warren is I don't think she would take a job if she believed that she wasn't going to be effective and wasn't going to get a chance to have a voice and to have a say in the direction of consumer protection. So, but I think you're right. It is a little strange that rather than just appointing her directly as director of the new Consumer Protection Bureau, she got this White House title. But
that's a political, job that, obviously you serve at the pleasure of the president. And her whole, idea of this agency initially as an agency was to ensure its independence. Now she is like working for the man in a sense.
True, but on the other hand, it will give her, I think, working in the White House, you could argue that it will give her some power to get things done and to perhaps even get around some of the rulemaking delay, because the problem with the bureaucracy is it takes months and months and sometimes years to pass a rule. And, I heard a presentation yesterday from the National Consumer Law Center. The prediction was that any rulemaking that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau does, any rules wouldn't go into effect until 2012.
So there you go, the whole sense of urgency about this. Isn't it infuriating? This is an urgent crisis. Oh, my God, people are out of work. People are getting foreclosed upon. We've got to act. We've got to do it right now. And then we get into this miasma of delay and frustration. I think, not only in the rulemaking process, but the appointment process. I mean, Obama has appointed, various people or nominated people who have yet to be acted on by the Congress because of the Republican, opposition to everything he says and does. And there was fear that, she would also face a very hostile confirmation process. What's the wrap against her? What can they say against this person? I mean, she's so congenial, so smart, and yet she's been sort of treated like she's a, if not a terrorist, certainly an old line communist. And there she is at Harvard's business school, the center of, kind of Leninism in our day.
Right. It is interesting to see how folks who say we need to have reasonable, common sense rules, when it comes to important transactions, buying a house, buying a car, all these things are really big and often the largest financial transactions people will do in their lifetimes. And to say that you can't have some sort of modest, rulemaking or reasonable rules on this sounds a little crazy, I think, but you definitely have folks who are sort of free market, free market is a religion, and that somehow the free market is going to magically fix everything if we just just step out of the way. But
they don't want to really talk about what's happened or where that, you know, ideology led. I mean, today in the New York Times, a big full-page ad from the Cato Institute, libertarian think tank, attacking President Obama, you know, and making no reference, you know, to, like, the financial crisis. You know, it's like the elephant in the room that they don't want to see or talk about. It's just incredible, or accept any responsibility for. Now, of course, the Republicans and many of our, you know, newspaper pundits and TV people, you know, tend to take a, you know, on the one hand, kind of analysis. You know, yes, the Republicans were largely, but the Democrats too, and at the core of it, they basically are criticizing people like you, Mike Hudson, who argued that we needed to do something about predatory lending and to stop, you know, redlining and these racist practices that denied loans and credit for people living in inner city communities that had a red line drawn around them when they wouldn't do any lending in those communities. And, you know, there was a Community Redevelopment Act that was passed, which has been the bugaboo of the Republicans. See? You guys did it. What's your take on all this? How did we get to this place?
Right. You know, people want to blame the Community Reinvestment Act or blame Fannie Mae and Freddie. And, you know, ultimately, you know, this has to be laid at the feet of Wall Street. I mean, Wall Street essentially created the subprime mortgage industry. It was a small corner of the market, very much a niche kind of industry. But once in the mid-1990s, when Wall Street discovered, hey, we can make a lot of money doing these kind of loans and packaging them and selling them off as securities around the world, that's what fueled the growth of subprime, and that's really what fueled a lot of the bad practices, a lot of things that happened to people.
Now, you studied all of this. To what degree do you believe that the people who were engaging in these kinds of deceptive selling practices and sleazy securitization practices and rating, you know, this junk as if it was, you know, triple A, you know, kind of the work, the value of, you know, kind of a message from God in some way, you know, what is your take on all of this? Did they know what they were doing? Did they care? In other words, was there an intent here to steal?
Well, definitely, folks within the mortgage industry knew that this thing had spun out of control. You know, you have to look at the history of the mortgage market. You know, you go back a generation or two. And a loan officer was usually a local bank vice president who sat in a glass office and whose job was to say no as often as he said yes. You know, there were problems with that. There was, as you said, there was redlining, there was discrimination against single women. But basically, you know, the idea was, you know, ask the question, can and will this loan be repaid? You know, you flash forward to 2004, and a loan officer was a 23-year-old kid who 6 months before had been working at Radio Shack. He was given a headset and told to call as many people as possible and say whatever it took to get them to agree to the mortgage. If he couldn't cut it, he was out of a job. But if he could sell like a pro, you know, and remember, you know, it's the ABC, always be closing, you know, he could make $100,000, $200,000, even $1 million a year. It was this incredible sort of boiler room atmosphere. As a matter of fact, AmeriQuest, the largest subprime lender, which was funded by basically all of the major Wall Street banks, used the movie Boiler Room with Ben Affleck and Giovanni Ribisi
as a training film?
As a training film.
Oh, my
absolutely.
God. You're kidding.
Oh, my God.
Oh, boy. So, you know, by the way, don't attack Radio Shack in this particular, on this station. This is where they got all the technology to create Progressive Radio Network,
right.
.com at Radio Shack. But at any rate, it's working, so let's keep it going here. Sherry, did you have a question? Sherry Welch, yes.
I do. First of all, I want to congratulate you for writing this book. I've learned a lot since reading portions of it. Yesterday, you wrote a very interesting piece on the 2-year anniversary of the economic crisis. What are your thoughts as to why we've had no investigation? And was this caused by systemic failure or mortgage fraud, Michael?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, some folks want to say, oh, well, you know, it was, you know, it wasn't fraud. It was, you know, these sort of large financial trends like low capital requirements and over-the-counter derivatives and, you know, global financial imbalances. And, you know, people talk about it, you know, especially commentators on NBC and places like that. They talk about it as if it was a, you know, essentially like a financial act of nature. It was just something that happened. It was a hurricane, and we had to respond to it. But the truth was, it was a man-made disaster. And mortgage fraud and other kinds of fraud, you know, outright Ponzi schemes, really helped fuel this boom and ultimately led to the bust.
Didn't they have what you refer to in your book as the lab, where they would send the mortgage documents to be doctored, whited out, photoshopped, et cetera?
Absolutely. I was, you know, when I started investigating AmeriQuest Mortgage for the LA Times back in 2004, 2005, you know, I talked to, you know, dozens of former employees who talked about the kind of tricks that they used. You know, they inflated people's incomes on the mortgage documents. They pressured the appraisers to inflate the home values. They forged people's signatures on the disclosure documents so they wouldn't know what was going on. And they actually did cut and paste. They would take a W-2, you know, the tax form you get every year, tell you how much you made. And, you know, they would take one from someone who had a, you know, a high-earning person, and then they would cut and paste somebody else's name on it and, you know, photocopy it and use a little whiteout to cover the shadows, and suddenly you would have a fake a W-2 for a borrower, which made it look like they could afford this loan.
See, these are just to jump in here for any listeners who might want to know some more. You know, Michael's book is excellent on this. My film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and the companion book, The Crime of Our Time, makes this case for fraud, for crime, for manipulation of markets, is an argument, an indictment, really, that is not really reflected very much in the media coverage, is it, Michael? I mean, this talk about, you know, fraud in any kind of systematic way is sort of basically, you know, it's not even there. You know, occasionally it's a footnote.
Right. It's interesting how quickly we have these financial scandals, financial disasters, and how quickly we learn the lessons of them. You go back to the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s, and it was essentially the same principle, but it had to do with, instead of with residential mortgages, it had to do with commercial mortgages. Savings and loans were making, you know, wild, irresponsible, reckless loans against big shopping centers and office towers and, you know, commercial real estate projects, based really on inflated appraisals, based on fictitious values of the underlying, you know, of the underlying collateral. Same thing, you know, 1,000 SNL insiders, executives, and employees were convicted of felonies, you know, during this era.
But we're not seeing that now, are we?
Yeah, you're right. But we very quickly forgot the lessons of the savings and loan scandal. We also forgot the lessons of the dot-com debacle. We forgot the lessons of Enron and the other accounting scandals that you know took place around the turn of the turn.
I mean, when you say we forgot, you know, there's nobody reminding us. It's not like you and me forgot it. I haven't forgotten it. But, you know, the media has sort of chosen to bury, deep six, to use the Watergate term, this whole history. It's a kind of United States of amnesia time. People don't want to know about it. Even my favorite dissectress here talked about the financial crisis started 2 years ago when it started in 2007. I mean, this is a situation of basically selective coverage, omission as much as commission, a refusal to really encounter all this. I was just in London, Mike, at visited my Mecca, you know, the London School of Economics, okay? And wanted to buy myself, you know, a little something at the shop. Found out that they refused to take American Express cards at the London School of Economics. So much for the integrity of our great card there. And I picked up a book myself there called by Howard Davies on the financial crisis. He's the director of the school, and his book is, you know, Who's to Blame? And he points out, he says, global unemployment is estimated to be 15 million higher than it was before the crisis. There's been an enormous loss of value in the financial sector, with estimates suggesting that financial firms will need recapitalization to the tune of $16 trillion. My own film carries a figure suggesting that $197 trillion has sort of vanished because of all of this stuff. And yet, this is like the story of our time, the crisis that will not go away. And it's sort of invisible to so many people. You know, it's right there in plain sight, and people don't want to talk about it. Why is that?
You know, the media, part of the problem is most media organizations are on what Columbia Journalism Review calls the hamster wheel. It's very much like what happened today and what happened yesterday and what's happening tomorrow. And I don't mean, you know, and I mean literally like the next day or the day before or today. You know, it's hard for reporters, even if they want to do the investigative reporting, they're under so much pressure to produce. It's hard for them to pull back and see the big picture and see things in a historical perspective. They really do treat they treat the financial crisis as something that just happened, and, you know, now we just need to report on what the ramifications are and what are the responses. But there's not a lot of appetite for digging into root causes. And part of that is just this sort of logistics of being in the news business. But part of it, I guess, is also ideological. Folks questioning, you know, powerful, large institutions is not something that especially American media are good at.
Absolutely true. You know, the financial news in London, which I picked up as I boarded the plane to come back last night, and I'm reading these articles, and here's the editor, William Wright, referring to the former chairman of Lazard in London, who's now chairman of Barclays. And he once said that only two things would survive a nuclear war: cockroaches and Lazard. And it says, on the evidence of the past few years, he underestimated the tenacity of the rest of the investment banking industry. And basically saying that the banks are reinventing themselves again. And in this magazine, back here on page 14, there's one of these great Where Are They Now sections, you know, which goes through the major players in the financial crisis. And they've reemerged elsewhere in the industry with high salaries and the rest. Not only are they not going to jail, they're laughing all the way to the bank. So, I mean, they're being rewarded here. And, you know, who's paying for it? Working people in London, Mike. The government, the new conservative, so-called liberal government, is proposing to cut 40%. 40% of funding, you know, for public service jobs. And the government is the largest employer in England, period, of jobs. If they cut back 40%, okay, that's going to be devastating. And just yesterday, there was the TUC conference, the Trade Union Congress. And at the Congress, they invited Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, like our Federal Reserve Bank, central banker, who came to tell the workers, you know, you're a bunch of good blokes, guys, but we have to make these cuts. There's no way around it. There's no discussion of any alternatives. And he comes there basically to praise them and then basically to tell them that, you know, yes, it's unfair, but we're going to have to do it anyway. And one of the union leaders said it was like going to a Christian church and finding out that Satan was the featured speaker. You know, I mean, it's bizarre. This is all crazy. I can't even read it. Yeah, you want to stop my rant? Do you have a question?
No. I want to comment that Michael wrote a wonderful piece, because there were people talking about this within the banking industry. Michael, could you explain a little bit about the silencing of the whistleblowers?
Right. Yeah. You know, there were folks who worked in the you know, worked in the mortgage industry and the bank industry who were fraud investigators. That was their job title. I was a, you know, mortgage fraud investigator. You know, and they were sort of by their job description essentially was be a whistleblower. And I talked to several folks at many of the largest financial institutions who worked as fraud investigators during this sort of boom era. And the story that they told me was strikingly similar in each case. You know, when they found fraud, when they identified loans that were based on fraudulent appraisals, when they identified large sort of Ponzi scheme, you know, real estate investment adventures, they weren't praised. They weren't promoted. They didn't get raises. They were actually criticized, according to them, criticized, harassed, demoted, and fired for doing their job.
Well, what more can we say? The people who committed the crimes are rewarded. The people who warned of the crimes are ignored or lose their jobs. I mean, you know, there's that case that 60 Minutes just kind of ran of the banker from UBS, the Swiss bank, who was warning about all the kind of illicit practices of Americans stuffing money in secret accounts in Switzerland or offshore and, you know, in consequence not paying taxes and engaging in all sorts of other practices that were not considered, let us say, kosher. Okay? He brought this to the attention of the FBI. It was the biggest investigation, which led to the repatriation of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars from various people. And then he ended up going to jail, being sent to jail, because he didn't disclose something that the government considered important, some relationship he had with somebody. And he's become, the whistleblower who blew the biggest whistle, you know, is now in federal prison. You know, so, I mean, this is bizarre. But you see, in order to know about this stuff, you have to pay attention to the details. That's where, you know, the real juice of all of this is. In the actual quotes, the actual stories of the people involved. That's what I try to get to in my movie Plunder. That's what I try to do in Debt We Trust. And what I came up against constantly was a sort of wall of denial. I mean, literally, progressives, people in activist groups, you know, yes, but, you know, shouldn't we really be discussing the situation in Botswana land? You know, they're not focusing on this at all. There's no real economic movement for economic justice. There are a couple organizations, Center for Responsible Lending, you know, et cetera and so forth, A New Way Forward, you know, but they're not having the impact, you know, on the media agenda. That's very troublesome.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Sherry.
I was going to ask you, does your book get into the abysmal failure of hemp and that J.P. Morgan is now in the foreclosure business? They almost put people through the Great Chase on a reality TV show that they have to jump through all these rings of fire to even get any attention to do a loan modification, and of course everything's set up and rigged so that they fail.
Right, but you know, I actually don't. In my book, I don't get into hemp because you know that's a newer development. In my book, basically, the time window for my book is basically the mid 1980s through 2008. I have done some writing for the Center for Public Integrity, which is at www.publicintegrity.org, about hemp. You know, when hemp was created, which is, you know, it's the Home Affordable Modification Program, you know, it was created with the goal of reducing folks' monthly payments so they could afford to stay in their homes. The goal was to modify 3 to 4 million mortgages. In the first year and a half, and roughly the first year and a half of the program, 420,000 mortgages had received permanent modifications, so somewhere between 10 to 15% of the goal.
So
right now
maybe,
we have this shadow. inventory of something like 7 million mortgages in default or in some stage of foreclosure around the country.
So maybe the people who were running HAMP were doing too much HAMP because they weren't really paying very much attention, you know, to I mean, it's a shocking failure. It's a ongoing failure. It's infuriating. Unfortunately, you know, by the time we get a Consumer Protection Bureau in place and with new rules by 2012, a lot of people are going to be living in the streets and diving in dumpsters in order to survive as unemployment continues to grow. And that's why this book, The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis, is really important for you to read. I'm looking forward to getting a copy and also maybe writing about it, because I think you know, Michael's an excellent writer. He wrote, you know, for the, what was that publication in the South, the Institute?
Southern Exposure magazine.
Southern Exposure, which are beautiful, beautiful magazine. He did some great work in this area, and I'm really happy, Mike, that you can join us on the program. I'd like to stay in touch with you and see if we can't do some stuff together to get the word out about all of this, and I'll let you know about when we're showing Plunder. I'd love you to come and check it out as well. So stay with us now, because Joshua Holland, senior editor, writer at Alternet, is going to be talking about his book, The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy and Everything Else the Right Doesn't Want You to Know About Taxes, Jobs, and Corporate America. Among other things, Mike, his title, I think, is longer than yours. But I'm not sure that matters. Please get Mike Hudson's book and stay with us here on News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Sherry, stick around.
Thanks, Danny. Thanks, Sherry.
Thanks, Michael.
We know that your life is hard, so please put down your guard. We'll send you a gift to give you a lift, a shiny new credit card. Don't fret if your funds are low, you can use it wherever you go. Whenever you do, your debts will accrue and give us a happy flow.
It's so fantastic.
Fantastic.
When you pay with plastic. With plastic.
Wait for our bills to come, just pay the minimum. The interest will grow on the money you owe and make us a tidy sum. If you should somehow see, we're going to hike your fees. And if you pay late, we're raising your rate and cutting on penalties.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Stephen Lindman hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour, Saturdays and Sundays, as well as currently on Thursdays, as an antidote to government and corporate propaganda on the most cutting-edge world and national topics. Distinguished guests are regularly featured to provide commentary and analysis impossible to the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation and what Project Censored calls junk food news. The Progressive Radio News Hour airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
The Progressive Radio Network, your premier progressive radio station.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops. Ned Bank walking the AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.
Lunda. I can't really sing, but I love that song by Polarity One. It's the theme song of the film Plunder. Joining us, Josh Holland from Alternet on the other coast, who is writing about some of these issues and is going to be chatting with us about them. Josh, if you like the song, maybe Alternet could finally recognize that the movie is out there and write about it. But that's my argument with Don Hazen, your boss, you know, to try to encourage him to pay a little attention to this stuff, you know. But nevertheless, I'm really happy to have you on. I mean, because I think this whole notion of big lies about the economy, you know, is something that really has taken hold in the minds of a lot of people who feel, you know, that somehow the deficit, you know, is what's really dangerous, and that we have to cut everything, including jobs and job creation and stimulus programs and the like. And actually, in the midst of this financial crisis, which they refuse to acknowledge, was brought about by, you know, this cabal on Wall Street and their various friends and associates and media allies who basically did not investigate what they were doing. So tell us, what is your take out there, you know, on the other coast about all of these issues? And just maybe start, give us your take on the appointment of Elizabeth Warren, which was announced yesterday as the now an assistant to President Obama on consumer protection issues.
Thanks for having me, Danny. Yeah, Elizabeth Warren's appointment is actually, I think, something that's sheer. She's a very outspoken advocate for consumers, and she is she's faced stiff resistance to get a Senate confirmation. So this is yet another Obama appointee who has been waiting, and you know, there's a whole list of appointees that have not been able to get confirmed by the Senate. They are going to give her an interim appointment, which is, I guess, the best that they can do. I think Matt Iglesias the other day said that the Obama administration was coming up with novel compromises that please nobody. And I think a lot of people would have liked to have seen the administration fight for a real permanent appointment for Elizabeth Warren.
But they're not fighters, and this is the problem. And part of the reason I think that the lies that you document, you know, in your book on the 15 biggest lies about the economy and everything else the right doesn't want you to know about, is you know, partly they're able to get traction, not just because Fox News pushes them, but because other media outlets do as well. There's no counter narrative. There's nobody challenging this stuff. Where are the truth detectors, you know, really taking these people on? And the government is so cautious and so, you know, risk adverse and so politically tepid about things that the loudest voice in the room tends to, you know, actually find a you know, support where you know, the White House is reacting. It's not acting.
The White House needs to take that new wonder drug called Groasit.
You know, I think you hit on a very important point. This isn't just a matter of right-wing think tanks putting out endless series of reports. It's also a matter of the so-called mainstream corporate media, and a lot of it comes down to reporters who aren't really qualified to get to the bottom of these issues, to the bottom of these debates, don't necessarily have the time to do so. And also there's this kind of standard neutral reporting style that's popular in the United States especially, where it's he said and she said, and the reporter's job is to, you know, get a pithy quote from one side and a pithy quote from the other side and put together a story. Not all stories have two sides. Not all arguments are worthy of the same weight. You brought up the deficit. I mean, right now we are being told that Americans are terribly concerned about the deficit. None of that is reflected in polling. What Americans are really concerned about is jobs and economic growth. And if you look at the latest numbers, it's appalling. Right now there's over 47 million Americans living in poverty. The poverty rate has hit 14%. This is, you know, an epic economic meltdown that's just killing us. And
but don't call it a depression, please. Let's you know, not use that
I mean
word.
That's one of those great technical debates. Is it a depression? Is it a recession? Does it really matter when you have 14% of your population living in poverty?
Well, it depresses me, I'll tell you that right now.
It's terribly depressing. I mean, there's no question about that.
So let's look at this. I mean, in other words, if you were Obama, if you were there, I mean, couldn't you make a convincing case that even if you don't believe anything the progressives are saying, even if you take this middle of the road, middle of the mush position, isn't it in your interest to encourage, you know, people on the left, in a sense, at the grassroots level, to speak up, to kind of answer and challenge the right wing, rather than to ignore them totally? I mean, it seems like, from their own point of view, it's a very stupid political stance.
Well, I mean, there's a partisan question here, which is that it seems to me that, you know, I am occasionally speaking to people who have access to the White House. I'm not one of those people who has a ton of access, but from what I get, there is a genuine belief in this administration that they can somehow peel off Republicans to work with them on these issues. And this is kind of an abiding belief, and no matter how many times they get smacked upside the head by the reality that they will get no support, they seem to continue to go in this direction. In the last couple of weeks, I guess, as a looming November smackdown is facing them, they are starting to become more aggressive rhetorically. But it's obviously too little, too late. If you look at the polls, what you see is not a whole lot of people who have decided, okay, I supported Obama in the last election and I hate him now, or I supported Democrats and I hate them now. What you see is a lot of people on our side who are just not going to go and vote.
Right.
Right,
and that's the big problem. When people are not inspired, when people are asleep and feel like there's no point in doing anything.
And when they're taken for granted. I mean, if you look at this Elizabeth Warren question, that would have been, it seems to me, an ideal time to make a very noisy public fight, in part because a lot of progressive opinion leaders are really, really fond of Warren and wanted to see this appointment made and wanted to see a fight over it.
You know, the thing about her is that she's so addicted to common sense approaches. I mean, she's not calling for like a revolution, the way Sherry Welsh does, that we need to overturn everything. You know, no, she's like very collected Harvard. You know, I went to Harvard. I know what it's like there, you know, sit in a Harvard seminar. It's, you know, it's not the news business. It's the snooze business. You know,
well, one of the points that I make in the book is that, you know, as a rhetorical strategy on the right, anybody who is even right smack dab in the center, but especially if you're ever so slightly to the left of center, they paint you as a Maoist. And that becomes the debate then, right? You know, and it's so far from reality. You're absolutely right. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is no radical. What she is someone who takes the position that a consumer protection agency should protect consumers very seriously.
I mean, this woman, have you ever tried to read bankruptcy law? I mean, this woman is an expert on bankruptcy law, okay?
That's right.
She knows everything about it, okay? I mean, I can't even, you know, I've got these books. I went to this conference of consumer bankruptcy lawyers, and these documents are, completely, you know, dense, okay? You can't even get through them. But she loves that stuff, and she's done a brilliant job in synthesizing it, and she's a great communicator, really. So much better than anybody in the Obama administration.
She really is.
From what I've seen, she could be their secret weapon, and yet they don't use her. They try to keep her up in the attic there, you know, unfortunately. And this is the problem, that this whole appointment, she could be sidelined instead of activated. What I want to try to get at, though, is something that's a little deeper in the stuff that you write about, and I know that folks at Alternate seem to love, okay? Look at what Sarah Palin is saying today. Look at what Glenn Beck is really saying. Look at, you know, Rush Limbaugh, what a liar he is, and all this. You know, focusing on constantly debunking these cartoon figures in a way, and elevating them to the level of, you know, the most serious threats to progressive change, without looking sometimes at who's behind them and how this whole kind of very skillful narrative has been created by, you know, not by the think tanks, the consultants there, who have come up with a strategy that seems to be winning, you know, the strategy of no. How did they put this together, and what's the chemistry here?
Well, I mean, I think that the strategy of no is it's the culmination of many, many years of very careful groundwork where they've demonized government itself. There is at the heart of these 15 lies that I discuss in the book is exactly that. It's an intellectual infrastructure that's been created on the right to serve as a counterbalance to so-called liberal media bias, but I would argue that it's a counterbalance to reality. And you have these ideas that are, you know, that have no basis in fact, and they get an enormous amount of traction in our discourse. Right now, there are actually many, many, many conservatives who believe that what's killing job growth is this idea of uncertainty about upcoming regulations, that businesses are not hiring because they're not sure of what's coming down the pike in the next year of the Obama administration. This is such a ridiculous narrative, and yet it's gained real traction because it starts with, you know, Heritage Foundation or someone like that, and it gets into an op-ed in the Washington Post, and it becomes transmitted and retransmitted to the whole kind of, until it really has become a real argument in our discourse, no matter the fact that it has no basis with reality, and you can see this in the numbers.
Let's go through your book, because we want people who are listening to buy this book, to get this book, right, Josh? We want them to be Hollandites here and support you and what you're doing, you know. So let's do them quickly in a truthiness exercise here. Conservatives, just give me one line response to why what you're arguing here. Conservatives don't want good government.
Well, I mean, the idea that limited government, the basic premise of that chapter is that limited government sounds great in theory, and it's a great rhetorical strategy, and people actually like what government does in the specific. So, you know, you could talk about, oh, big government is terrible. People like to have subsidized student loans. They like their roads to not have potholes, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, and I don't want the government messing with my Medicare.
Right.
What about?
We are rather fond of the library, which happens to be government.
It's not your fault. There aren't enough good jobs anyway. So what is that argument?
Well, so these chapters don't necessarily, these headings don't necessarily correlate to the arguments perfectly. That's a discussion of inequality and the fact that, you know, there is this kind of this zombie myth, it will not die, that the United States economy is the most upwardly mobile in the world. That's not true. We've, you know, upward mobility is a thing of the past in this economy. We've actually
Tell me about it, Josh. I was called a hero of downward mobility. Okay, some years
exactly.
ago.
I mean, we're less upwardly mobile than many advanced Western countries with which we compete. And, you know, so this idea, it internalizes the economic problems that we have as individuals. So you're told all the time that this is the land that you can get ahead in, the land of opportunity where the streets are paved with gold. And when you don't actually see that in your own economic fortunes, what do? Well, you look at yourself and you say, there must be something wrong with me.
You know, that's a great saying that about the streets being paved with gold. In at Ellis Island here, there's a exhibit of the immigrants who've come to America, and in the Italian section of the Italians who came, there's somebody quoted up on the wall there, okay, which says, you know, we were told that the streets were paved with gold, and then we found out the streets weren't paved at all, and that we were going to be the ones to pave them. You know, so that is it. It's in the eye of the beholder. But you know, I really think, and I really want to congratulate you for your work here in trying to challenge all of this and to try to set the record straight on this whole economic agenda being pushed by the conservatives, but also unfortunately indulged a lot by the Democrats and by, you know, big media that even though they're critical here and there, basically take this line and take this position, and they need to be challenged as well. And I would just say, I really would like to see alternate and playing a bigger role. I mean, you've featured some excellent writing about the economy, no question, but we need to have more. What can we do? How can we fight back? How can we stand in solidarity with the homeowners losing their homes and people who are jobless getting jobs? All of this, you know, is something we need to offer a program for people to get involved. I know there's a march coming up on October 2nd, which I think is very promising. One Nation, they have quite a comprehensive program. We talked about it here last week. But we need to try to kind of get on, work together somehow. I mean, one of the strengths of the right is that they have these message points, and everybody takes these message points, and they work together. They're not in this competitive, mine is bigger than yours and better than yours kind of mentality, so that there's no critical set of ideas. It's like, you know, 20 people, 1,000 ideas. We need to focus this now. Don't you agree?
I do. I think that part of that is inherent to our ideology. I mean, liberals don't necessarily follow the leader in the same way as conservatives do. I interviewed Richard Viguerie, a kind of great organizer of the conservative movement going back to the 50s a few years ago, and he said something that stuck in my mind. He said, you know, we are descended from monarchists, so we are kind of conditioned on the right that what the king says is something that you really pay a lot of attention to, and you don't buck the king. And, you know, liberals are, you know, you get 20 liberals in the room, you are going to get, you know, at least 21 opinions about things, and it's very hard to get, you know, to get the left in lockstep where it's all herding right. cats. I mean,
well,
part
I'll tell
of
you,
that is something that I wouldn't want to give up.
Well, I don't know.
I wouldn't want to give up my
We're
you know,
running
my
out of time, Sherry.
Thought.
Hit your questions. I'm not suggesting giving up independent thought. I'm just saying, like,
let's
independently think together a little bit more than we do. That's my point.
I'm not suggesting that you're saying that we should do that. I'm just saying that it's an inherent obstacle.
Sherry?
You know? I mean, you just can't put out a message at the top and expect everybody to
okay,
to kind
true.
Of
follow I don't, I'm not sure where the top is. Sherry, what's your thought?
Joshua, in your book, you address the subject of unions, and I think that unions helped create the middle class. This March on Washington, One Nation Working Together .org, don't you see that if we can get more people to get behind the movement of recreating, reinvigorating, reinventing unions, that we can start taking a wee bit more of our power back and get rid of a lot of the corporatocracy that we currently reside in?
I mean, I do. And I think that, you know, the labor movement in general is underappreciated in terms of its significance. If you look not only in the United States, but in every country, I discussed this in the chapter, as union participation decreases, inequality increases. And what the right has done in this country is they've taken unions and they've made it a personality issue. They've made it a social kind of issue. They've bashed unions based on this kind of cliche or stereotype of corrupt union organizers. And what they've tried to do is obscure the very central fact that when you're in a labor union, you make what's known as a union wage premium. You get paid 11% more than your colleague who is not in a labor union. And if you include benefits in that, and not just wages, it's a 30% more. So, you know, we're at a point right now where the largest share of national income is going to investors, and the smallest share, since they started tracking this in World War II, the smallest share is going to wages. And that has come about at the exact time that, you know, the exact period, the 30-year period, where labor union participation has gone down from 30-some-odd percent to, in the private sector now, something like 7% and 10% overall, government workers.
What a terrible shame this is. These are figures we need to really understand, and I hope that your book and the work that Alternet does will reach more people. The book is the 15 biggest lies about the economy and everything else the right doesn't want you to know about taxes, jobs, and corporate America. The author,
Pushing the Frontier on the Longest Title Ever.
Joshua Holland has been with us. I hope you'll come back, Josh. We certainly at this program want to be supportive of Alternet. We want to work with them. We'd like them to pay a little attention to what we do from time to time as well. At any rate, let's stay in touch and let's try to get the word out as best we can. People who want to reach me can write to dissector@mediachannel.org or to reach Sherry as well. And Sherry Welch is the dissectress who is producing this program, sort of my co-host when I let her get a word in, you know, edgewise here, which sometimes I don't do enough. We just want to say a little in memoriam note for Edward Newman, who was at NBC for many years and sort of committed to rather old-fashioned ideas like literacy, wit, and intelligence. And he was on the air for 3 decades. He died at age 91. So we want to pass that along. I'll be back here next week on News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. You can listen. You'll be able to download the podcast from their website later today, and I will also be tweeting it, Facebooking it, and also be on with you as well. So I hope that we'll get a little bit more feedback on this program. I think we're on at a time when people are still having that first cup of coffee and hence not calling in on radio shows, but we're here, we're talking away, we're trying to raise issues that are important, and we will continue to do so. PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com has a new video that's up on it that you might want to check out. In the meantime, thank you very much for tuning in, for being with us, Sherry, to you, to our guest Josh, and Mike Hudson. And next week, I'm hoping that Ted Rawl will join us. He's just back from Afghanistan. I've got a great story to tell you about a conference I was just in London where I ran into this guy, and I said, well, what do you do? He says, oh, I'm in military intelligence. I work in the Pentagon for the Red Cell Unit in military analysis, and I write about that in my latest piece up on mediachannel.org, News Dissector blog. So check it out. Thanks again for being with us. We'll be back next week. If the creek don't rise and the Lord lets us.
I've traveled across this country from shore to shining shore, and it really made me wonder all the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer who couldn't not pay his loan. I heard the auction hammer knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the weary miners lose their lives in some dark hole, while the owner makes his fortune on that cheap non-union coal. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miners sweated for. I see.